This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Deborah and Annie, I'd like to welcome you to New Books in Genocide Study and say thanks so much for agreeing to be with us today.
Thank you for having us. It's great to be here.
I was so impressed with your book, which is a fascinating collection of essays, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it with you. And so I would just ask you to start, and we'll start with Deborah, by saying just a little bit about who you are and how you got to be interested in atrocities and mass violence.
Sure. Well, I'm currently a research fellow at the University of Wollongong, which is just south of Sydney in Australia. And genocide studies has always been my passion, really, from when I was an undergraduate student. As a child, I think, or as a teenager at school, I learned about the Holocaust and was really horrified to learn about what happened, but had kind of received a naive education that really didn't go into other genocides, and I naively had some faith in the concept of never again. And so when I got to university and was doing a history major and enrolled in a subject called the Holocaust and Genocide, I was utterly horrified to learn that, in fact, the international community really hadn't held to its promise of never again after the Holocaust, and I was just shocked to learn about the Cambodian genocide, to learn about what happened in the Balkans, in Rwanda, and I just felt that this was really an indictment on the world as a whole. And that led to an honours thesis and then into a PhD. And so I've always been very passionate about genocide studies and genocide prevention, and it's led into this career now.
And how about you, Annie?
I would say similar to Deborah. It was, through my education career that I sort of fell into this topic, if you will. I don't think I had as clear a path of progression as Deborah, but I started learning Indonesian way back in primary school, and I continued through high school and then into university. And I was mainly doing an Indonesian studies major. And as part of that degree, I got to spend about a year of my undergraduate studies studying in Indonesian universities. And while I was there, I happened to be doing a project, and I had this journalist friend, and we had to write a little project on some form of research in Indonesian studies. And so I went with my journalist friend just to see what she was doing. And she happened to be interviewing a couple of women who had been detained in what were essentially concentration camps in the late 60s and early 70s in Indonesia. And I came away from that interview, where I really just sat in the room and didn't make a noise. I came away from that interview and I asked my journalist friend, I said, what's this thing with the detention camps? What is this woman talking about? And it was really a point of revelation for me, because I had never heard of these massacres that had swept across Indonesia in the mid-60s. And from there, it kind of progressed into, again, like what Deborah did, a smaller research project at the undergraduate level for honours, and then into a PhD. And that was back in 2002. So I've really been interviewing people from this period for about a decade now, and I think I'll continue doing it for much of the rest of my career. So I guess I kind of accidentally fell into genocide studies from learning about these horrific events in Indonesia, and I've just continued on with it in my career, and I'm now mainly teaching Indonesian studies, but also Southeast Asian studies, which includes quite a look at the quite dark histories in this region of mass atrocities and genocides. So, yeah, I guess that's how I started.
So how did you all come to write this book?
Or
edit the book, I'm sorry.
We were both working at the Asia Pacific Centre for the Responsibility to Protect at the University of Queensland, which was a centre set up after the Responsibility to Protect a doctrine was agreed on at the World Summit in 2005. And the Responsibility to Protect was a statement that highlighted countries' own responsibility to protect their populations from genocide and mass atrocities, but also the international responsibility to do so. And after the summit, after the World Summit, a number of centres were set up to focus on R2P, as it's called for short, and Annie and I were both employed in the Asia Pacific Centre at the University of Queensland. And we decided that just through discussions and so on, that there really was a relative lack of focus on genocide and mass atrocities in Asia, as opposed to sort of a much more strong focus on events in Europe and even in Africa. So the idea first germinated as an idea for a workshop to get a group of people together who were specialists in the region and see what we could explore. And that in turn ultimately led to the volume.
Yeah, I was really struck by the similarities in the stories you both of you told about how you became interested in this and about the way in which you were shocked or surprised to discover the kind of history of mass violence. And I have to say, I've always kind of assumed, you point that out in the introduction to the book, that this is a story that has gotten little attention and not really been told very well. And I have to confess, I've always kind of thought that was true for people who studied or were born in the United States or Europe and kind of expected that would not be true for people in Australia. But perhaps it is. And so I guess I'm wondering, why is it that region and what has happened there has received so little attention?
Well, I think it's understandable in a lot of ways why there is a greater focus, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century, particularly on the Holocaust and within studies of genocide, but also in Rwanda, former Yugoslavia, Armenia, again, that more European focus. Mm-hmm. And in terms of why there's less of a focus in Australia on these regions, I think it's partly a legacy of our educational system, in that we have quite a legacy of English education systems. And it's really only been in the last 15 to 20 years that you've seen a shift, particularly in historical studies in Australia, to look more at our region, but also at our own past. And so, like I think a lot of post-colonial countries and settler colonial countries, we've only sort of recently started to look at our own past and the atrocities committed as part of the colonisation project in countries like Australia, Canada, and North America more generally. And so I think it's partly a turn in historical studies more generally. In terms of looking at cases of mass atrocities in Asia, there have been quite excellent studies done on individual cases in Asia. I mean, there's been excellent work done on the Cambodian genocide in particular, some of the mass loss of life under Mao in China, certainly on Japanese expansionism during and before World War II, but not so much comparative work. There's really only been individual case studies as far as I can, when we look across at the field.
And I guess if I can jump in and add to that, I think Annie will agree with me that Australia's kind of always sat a little bit uncomfortably in terms of knowing its position. We've always looked to Britain historically as our former colonial power for much of our policy and much of our sense of place in the world. Yet the reality is that we are located in the Asia Pacific region. And that's been quite an uncomfortable dichotomy in some ways in both the Australian educational system and in our approach to foreign affairs. The sense of, you know, do we look to Britain? Do we look to the United States, which is obviously our closest, most powerful ally? Or do we look to countries that are much closer to us geographically? And I think our history curriculum over time has been influenced by all of those factors, but only in recent decades more by our geographical location than perhaps our historical and political connections. And as a result, the types of languages and the types of histories that have been taught in schools have often been very focused on Europe. Yet at the same time, we had large numbers of refugees from the Vietnam War, large numbers of refugees from the Cambodian genocide arriving in Australia and starting to build their lives here as both Annie and I were growing up. Yet the experiences of these people wasn't really critically examined very closely, probably in much the same way as when many Jewish refugees from World War II arrived in Australia in the late 40s and early 50s. The focus then was also on, you know, assimilation, acculturation, and building a life rather than examining that past. And only with time, perhaps, has it come a little bit more full circle to examine the past. And are we as a country sort of incorporating those narratives as part of our story too?
So you divide the book into two parts, legacies and prevention. And just looking at legacies first, Annie, you write about this effort to wrestle with the legacies of violence in Indonesia. Can you say something about what's been done in Indonesia in an attempt to address past violence and how successful it's been?
Yes. I suppose I should sketch a short narrative here in order to explain
Please.
My answer. Indonesia has an authoritarian military government for over 32 years, and it ended, it was called the New Order Government, and it ended in 1998. And in the immediate post-New Order period, there were a number of excellent reforms put in place, particularly under the presidents Habibi and Abdurrahman Wahid, better known as Gusdur. These were sort of the first two post-authoritarian presidents. And under the two of them, they really did a great deal to reform some of the worst forms of governance in Indonesia. So they did things like reform the constitution, effectively putting in a Bill of Rights into the new constitution. They created legislation around human rights, around ad hoc human rights courts. The military was removed from holding seats within the parliament. They set up free and fair elections. They removed many of the very harsh and discriminatory articles of law, such as those used to silence opposition to the government, such as the hate sowing articles that were used against pretty much anyone who wanted to criticise the government, and all sorts of things. And these were excellent reforms. But since these early reforms, there has been very little consolidation or progression. Right? We might call them second generation reforms that are meant to build on these first round of reforms that were done roughly between 1999 and 2003. And these second generation reforms, they simply haven't happened. Pretty much since the current president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, who's known as SBY or SBY, he was elected to his first term in 2004 and will be finishing his second term next year. And pretty much for the whole length of his administration, very little has happened in terms of consolidating these very good reforms. A very obvious example is Law Number 34 from 2004, if I'm not wrong, which was on the Indonesian military, which was supposed to do a number of things, including to divest the military of its vast business holdings by 2009. And this simply hasn't happened. And so the military remains a semi-autonomous empire, I guess you'd say, with very little civilian oversight, which, as you can imagine, is very dangerous for protecting civilians from abuses. Another area of concern are the long delays in revising some of the crucial legislation in the country, such as the Criminal Code, which is terribly inadequate and which doesn't hold up to Indonesia's obligations under various international conventions, such as the Convention Against Torture and Ill Treatment. And so I guess overall, Indonesia has made impressive reforms that should have, had they been followed through, done much to address past and current violence, but these short. I guess that's my answer.
So let me ask, during this time of transition, after the authoritarian government is eased out of power, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's the best description of it, but that's what we'll go with. Where are they looking for examples of how to deal with past atrocities? Are they looking to, the Nuremberg trials or other places? Where is this essentially autonomous or indigenous?
I would say Indonesia has no real interest in dealing with its past, to be frank.
Okay.
In the immediate post-authoritarian period, there were these laws set up to hold ad hoc human rights courts. And there have been a few, but each one of them has been a complete failure. There is also a national human rights body called Komnas HAM, which does some excellent work to investigate past abuses and which has produced some excellent thorough reports on very grievous crimes in the past. Each one of these reports has been rejected by the Attorney General's Department with such ridiculous excuses as they're incomplete or they're not thorough enough, all right? And essentially what it is there's a very strong lack of political will on the part of Indonesian political elites to sort of open up the Pandora's box of very serious crimes against humanity that have happened over quite a long period in Indonesia, nor are they at all willing to try and tackle the current crimes against humanity going on in certain areas, particularly West Papua. So Indonesia, it's not at a place yet where it's ready to look at past or even current crimes. And so, and any sort of discussion that happens at the international level about, for example, Indonesia ratifying the UN Convention on Genocide or the Rome Statute is very quickly shut down because Indonesia will never accede to any of those conventions. It considers it Western interference. And so Indonesia is in some ways a good example of democratic reform post-authoritarianism, but in a lot of other ways, it's exactly what you should not do post-authoritarian regime.
So, Deborah, we don't clearly have time to go through each and every essay, but is Indonesia the exception in terms of dealing with the legacy of mass violence, or is it more typical than we might wish in Asia?
I think probably Annie's better placed to answer that question. Did you want to answer that, Annie?
Please.
Yeah, sure. Just quickly, I would say, interestingly, Indonesia is a bit of a paradox. When you look at the region of Southeast Asia, where you have a number of what you would call semi-democracies, but also some very quite ingrained, recalcitrant, more authoritarian regimes, and that's probably half the members of ASEAN, Indonesia is, particularly over the last 15 years, positioned itself quite self-consciously as a leader on human rights, which, looking back 10 years ago, is quite a bizarre thing, really, to move from an authoritarian regime to a country which wants to be seen as a leader in the region on human rights is something quite new and exciting. And particularly under President SBY, Indonesia's tried to position itself much more strongly within ASEAN. And they were responsible in a lot of ways for the creation of the ASEAN Human Rights Body, the Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights, or AICHR, a few years ago. And they have been quite vocal on some humanitarian issues within the region. For example, last year, the former Vice President Yusuf Kalla was the ASEAN Special Envoy on addressing abuses against Rohingyas in Rakhine State in Burma. And so they've made a couple of admirable forays into regional issues, but they haven't translated these, words into actual concrete steps to protect civilians domestically.
And I think
go ahead.
If I can just jump in there, I think I'd just probably add to that. If we look at the, in terms of legacies, if we look at transitional justice efforts in Asia compared to globally, I think we can sort of really see some points of difference there. So obviously we've had the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and for the former Yugoslavia that have attempted to deal with the mass atrocities that occurred in those places. But the hybrid tribunal in Cambodia, the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, has probably achieved and is likely to achieve much less than either the ICTY or the ICTR. And events like the atrocities in Indonesia in 1965 and 1966 are really unlikely to see any, there's really unlikely to be any form of transitional justice in the wake of those. And similarly, East Timor's Commission for Truth and Justice and Reconciliation was a much less powerful body that had to negotiate in a much more compromised position in terms of some sort of transitional justice or reconciliation after the events in East Timor. So I think that's a place where we can see some real points of difference in terms of addressing the legacies of mass atrocities in Asia compared to elsewhere.
And if you can speculate, why those points of difference? Why did it turn out this way, at least so far?
Look, that's a really interesting question. I think one of the factors that one can point to is, to some extent, regime continuity and the continued power of perpetrators or those very closely aligned with perpetrators of some of these crimes. So, for example, East Timor remains very dependent on its much more powerful neighbour, Indonesia, which really limits its capacity to try and have any of the mass atrocities with which, you know, the Indonesian military was involved addressed. Or similarly, in the wake of the Cambodian genocide, the Cold War saw the West continue to support the Khmer Rouge even after it was overthrown and give the Khmer Rouge Cambodia's seat at the United Nations right through until the peace process in the early 90s. And that sort of continuity of involvement of the Khmer Rouge really prevented any sort of step towards justice for the terrible crimes that they committed. So I guess I'd suggest that that kind of continuity of power associated with the perpetrators has been a major contributing factor. Did you want to add anything else there, Annie?
I would agree with that. I think the cases that have come up for any sort of transitional justice in Asian contexts are vastly different and were probably more comparable with latent cases in Latin America, where you have a quite considerable passage of time before there's really space or political will to carry out these forms of and mechanisms of transitional justice. And while I believe there's much to be gained from doing comparative studies of different mechanisms of transitional justice, each one has to be contextualized within the political and social atmosphere of it happening. So, and the Asian cases are in so many ways very different from their counterparts in other parts of the world.
Mm. Yeah, I was really struck in the essay about East Timor, and I'm sorry to forget the author's name right now, but I was struck by the argument that one of the political leaders in East Timor was making, that I think the phrase was social justice was more important than, I don't know what, transitional justice, or the importance of working on issues like unemployment and poverty was more pressing and more important than the effort to get justice for past crimes.
Yeah, that was Heather Castell's article on the CAVR. And in many ways, the only approach that you can have for looking at transitional justice in Timor-Leste, which is Timor has had to choose pragmatism over mm-hmm. achieving justice for the past, because of their proximity to Indonesia and because their future depends on their relationship with its neighbours, first and foremost Indonesia. So whether that's a good enough result for the people of Timor-Leste, I don't think so, but it's certainly the path that has been chosen by its leaders.
So what are the things that comes out from these essays, and I guess I'll ask Deborah to answer this first, is the historical unwillingness of the rest of the world to intervene in the incidents of mass violence that occur in Asia. It's in a variety of specific essays, and it forms a backdrop for most of them. Can you say a little bit about why this was? Why the world was so reluctant to intervene?
Look, I think there's a global level of reluctance to intervene. Unfortunately, it's very much been the typical response to genocide and mass violence rather than an atypical response. And I think we can point to a number of factors that are probably of global influence, although perhaps some even more so in Asia. And one of them is the principle of sovereignty and the idea of non-inviolability of sovereignty. So obviously our nation state system is built on the idea of sovereign rights and non-intervention. And that's taken perhaps even more seriously in Asia than anywhere else in the world, where it's really seen as unacceptable to interfere at any level with the so-called internal affairs of a state, even when those internal affairs may include massive violence against the state's own citizens. And this has really led to a situation of leaders who are perpetrating genocide having really complete complete sanction to do whatever they wish. On one hand, this is how our nation state system works, but on the other hand, it's led to these terrible crimes such as the Cambodian genocide, in which, you know, there was, of course, no possible desire to intervene by any of the powers that might have done so, or the United Nations, or anything like that. And of course, there's also issues of realpolitik of Western governments that are dependent on voters for their support, and there's a sense that if you start sending lots of troops in to these countries and many start coming home in body bags, that you'll lose support. So it's a high risk activity to intervene in genocide, and it's often politically a relatively low cost not to intervene. And that has changed in recent decades to some extent. The idea of completely ignoring what's going on globally is much less acceptable than it was 2 decades ago, for example. However, there's a sort of a vast distance between that and really effective action to prevent or curb a genocidal situation of mass atrocities. And so what we're more likely to see now is, you know, our statements, efforts to work with the United Nations, sometimes, you know, very slow deployment of ineffective multilateral forces, such as in Darfur, because they fulfill a mandate of being seen to be taking some sort of action without actually taking effective action. And even something like that is probably much less likely in Asia because of the strong focus in the region on sovereignty.
Yeah, let me go back a little bit to the change you suggest, and I want to press you a little bit on two elements of that. And Deborah, you wrote your essay in a really, I thought, ingenious way, kind of speculating, looking at Cambodia as it happened, and then looking at the kind of constraints that led the world not to, or the factors that led the world not to intervene in Cambodia, and speculating about if you move those forwards to today, would those factors still be true? And so one of those changes is, as you suggested earlier, the introduction of the responsibility to protect. And so I'd like you to say something about, and Annie, you can chip in too if you want, about the degree to which the responsibility to protect has changed things, either rhetorically or practically.
Sure. Well, there's been a lot of hype around the responsibility to protect, both positive hype and negative hype, I would say. And look, it certainly can be seen as a landmark in terms of having 193 United Nations member states at the World Summit in 2005 all agreeing to this statement that, you know, nations must take primary responsibility for protecting their own populations from genocide and mass atrocities, that the international community has a role to play when nations are manifestly failing to protect their own communities from this kind of violence, and also by acknowledging the need for early warning and the need for a focus on prevention. So it certainly can be regarded as a landmark achievement in those in that sense. However, at the kind of discussions that have happened at the theoretical and rhetorical level really haven't consistently played out when one actually starts to look at mass atrocities that have occurred since the advent of R2P. So we've had a number of crises since 2005. Obviously, the situation in Darfur was unfolding as R2P was negotiated. Mm-hmm. But also since then, we've had Libya and Syria. And what we've seen is a relatively inconsistent application of this notion of the responsibility to protect, and a much stronger hypothetical rhetoric about the power of R2P than its application to case studies. So what I wanted to do in my chapter was actually to examine in a very applied way whether R2P would be able to overcome some of the critical barriers that are likely to be there, you know, if and when the next genocide happens somewhere in Asia or anywhere around the globe. And what I concluded was that while it's able to, you know, really, while both progress more broadly since the Cambodian genocide and greater human rights progress such as R2P are likely to overcome some of the barriers that prevented any international response to the Cambodian genocide, really there are a number of critical gaps that still remain, and that if we are serious about genocide prevention as a global community, we need to be thinking about those gaps now rather than in a crisis situation.
And Annie, I'll give you the first crack, I guess, at that. The second change I was noticing in the essays, and that's the development of a large and active, at least on a global level, civil society. And my background's in European history, and European historians especially talk about civil society emerging toward the end of the Soviet Empire and helping along 1989 and then kind of exploding, especially with the emergence of the internet and Twitter and a variety of social medias. What impact has that had on this issue of prevention of mass atrocities and genocide?
I would say certainly within the Southeast Asian region, which is my area of specialty, I would not like to so much comment on parts of North Asia.
Sure.
But I think really if you look at any action that's happened, it's only happened because of civil society groups in the Southeast Asian region. Collectively, these groups have been responsible for the little progress that we have seen over more recent years. For example, if we talk about the ASEAN bloc, collectively within the Southeast Asian region, there has been some progress. ASEAN, under continuous pressure from these civil society groups of human rights organisations and their like, over quite a few years, finally set up the Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights in 2009 because of this ongoing pressure. And any progress that has been made, it's been pushed by these groups, which often, again in pragmatic terms, need to work with governments in order to achieve this action. There is also, of course, a host of other human rights organisations which work more outside government spheres, again, depending on the country that they're in, because in certain countries in the ASEAN bloc, you can't have non-government approved NGOs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are some very real constraints on how these groups organise within the region. But I would certainly say that any progress we have seen has been due to the tremendous and brave efforts by some extraordinary groups of people in the region, definitely.
You talk in your introduction especially about the importance of a regional perspective. And so we've touched on this in a couple areas, but I thought I'd broaden the question out. What can we learn about genocide and the legacy of genocide and mass violence, about preventing mass violence, from looking at Asia?
Well, I would I'll just cut in here and give my opinion. I guess for someone who comes at this from a very strong Southeast Asian / Indonesian, again, it's about drawing fruitful research from when you do the comparative studies. For example, I'll just give you a short list of what I think are some of the more obvious areas for comparative studies in genocide studies from the region. For example, I think there could be a lot more work done on comparing man-made famines as part of genocidal processes, both the collectivization and forced labor projects under, for example, Mao, Pol Pot, with those under Stalin, as well as in Timor-Leste during the late 1970s and early 1980s under the Indonesian occupation. There, I think, there is an important study to be done there. There's also comparisons that need to be made with Asian studies, Asian context rather, on the steps which lead to genocide, particularly around incitement and mobilisation of populations. For example, looking at various propaganda campaigns which incite large parts of the population to pick up weapons and start attacking their neighbours. Just off the top of my head, the propaganda campaigns in the mid-60s in Indonesia against leftists could be quite easily compared with those under Franco in Spain in the late 30s. The incitement propaganda in Rwanda. Of course, also the forms of killings and mass deprivations against particular groups need to be done as well, comparing the forced labour and starvation that happened in European cases with those in Cambodia, Timor-Leste, Indonesia, and so on. And also other particular forms of violence that are often a large part of genocidal violence, for example, forms of child soldiering between African cases and the extensive use of child soldiers over the last 40 years in Burma is something which is terribly under research. So those are just off the top of my head things that I think could benefit a great deal from comparative research. Deborah, what do you think?
Look, I'd agree. I think both Annie and I really found when we started doing the research for this book that there is really a lack of comparative studies of Asian and non-Asian examples, and to some extent Asian and other Asian examples as well. So certainly we're hoping that, you know, not only has our book contributed to this comparative approach, but that it will hopefully inspire and encourage more comparative approaches. I think other lessons that can perhaps be taken specifically from Asian examples are the nature of the victim groups that can be targeted by these crimes, which often are subtly different in many respects in the Asian examples compared to sort of perhaps European examples or other examples of genocide. Sometimes we have less defined groups targeted, such as in the Great Leap Forward in China, where there's this massive mortality for social engineering purposes. But in terms of targeted groups, it's much more diffuse. And similarly, we can look at sort of how in the Cambodian example, we have groups such as minority groups who would qualify as victims of genocide under the United Nations Genocide Convention. And at the same time, we have the majority Khmer population also targeted with the same treatment often and the same severity of conditions often, although not always, but not necessarily considered as victims of genocide under the UN definition. Yet in many respects, that's a very artificial distinction. So I think that examining victim groups offers one way in which looking at Asian case studies can really add to the knowledge base. But I also think from a prevention perspective, looking at the role of regional organisations in Asia compared to elsewhere can also be very illuminating, because in Asia we have a region where regional organisations are relatively weak and relatively uninterested in issues of human rights. And if we contrast that with the UN's work on mass atrocity prevention and also the African Union's work on trying to prevent mass atrocities in their region, we can see some real differences and perhaps real opportunities for prevention work as well.
And you talk about prevention. Well, one of the ways you end your book is to point out that regions within Asia are at great, or some regions within Asia are at great risk for mass violence in the future. Can you say a little bit about where and why and what kind of efforts are being made to prevent this?
Sure. Well, look, I think as Annie said, we have the Rohingya in Burma who are very vulnerable currently, and this is on the what are termed the risk list for genocide and mass atrocities. There's a number of lists out there that identify countries at higher risk, and we can see that Burma comes in at the highest risk level on many of these risk lists, which just highlights how vulnerable these people are. And we also have the ongoing situation in North Korea, which obviously, you know, has not changed for some time, but nevertheless, there's really no doubt that the terrible suffering going on in North Korea that is just sort of often remains uncommented on. And we also have, you know, a number of human rights concerns in China, particularly with the Tibetan people. So there's a number of areas in the region where there are very real concerns and serious challenges in terms of how to address those concerns. Annie, did you want to add to that at all?
I guess I have a number of sort of hot points in my mind about over the next sort of 10 years where worrying trends might get worse or they might get better. And again, off the top of my head, I guess I would again mention Burma, because we have to question about how democratic will the transition be. I mean, after the 2015 general elections, can we expect another landslide victory for the Hutu Party, the USDP, or is Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy going to get a fairer share of seats? And how much violence can we expect around these elections? And elections in general tend, I don't want to say attract violence, but they become peak points for violence in various parts of the region. Indonesia next year has presidential elections, which are going to be very tense, that need to be watched. Other places in the region are having referendums and elections coming up. Bougainville in PNG is supposed to be getting an independence referendum as early as 2015, which again is a point to watch considering the history of violence there. Major regional issues like West Papua are, I think, only going to get worse before they get any better. There's been a lot of international attention on West Papua for the last few years, merited, certainly. And I think Indonesia really needs to find a less violent way to resolve the independence claims from West Papua. Also in Indonesia, I think a lot of people are watching to see how bad issues around religious intolerance are going to get. There's been increasing numbers of spates of violence, pogroms and so forth, against religious minorities in Indonesia, such as against Shia and Sufi and Ahmadi Muslims, also against Christians. And will these become a wedge issue that will drive more frequent and indeed larger incidents of mass violence? And so these are particular issues, but you have to put them against the very long-standing issues of persecution of certain minority groups within the region as well. For example, against minority groups living in the Upper Highland regions of mainland Southeast Asia, against, you know, particular groups in parts of northeastern India, which has seen some horrific violence, as Deborah mentioned, in Tibet, Xinjiang, but also other minorities, particularly in southern China. I mean, all of these things have been going on for 50, 60 years, but they still bear monitoring. And I guess, so there's a number of issues that I think we're looking at over the next 10 years at least.
You pointed several times to Indonesia. I'm just wondering, to what degree do you think, as I understood your comments, the kind of failure of transitional justice efforts in Indonesia, to what degree is that a contributor to the potentials for future violence?
I think it's probably the greatest predictor, actually. I have to say that as much as I appreciate the efforts that have been made in Indonesia and other places to reform their militaries, to professionalize their police and all these sorts of things, until you have some form of reliable accountability for crimes committed by such organisations and institutions, you can't expect any real improvement on the ground in terms of protection for civilians. Indonesia is a classic case. There is very little.
And I think if I just add to that, impunity for mass atrocities is well recognized as a contributor to increased cycles of violence and violence of increased intensity. And in fact, you know, if you could sort of Barbara Harf's predictors of mass atrocities, past genocide is well known as a predictor for future genocide, and part of that is this impunity issue. So transitional justice and dealing with the legacies is not just an issue of addressing the past, but also about changing the future. And I think when we first looked at doing this volume, one of the reasons why we chose to look at legacies and prevention is because we really think that they're inherently linked, and that you can't just prevent or change the future of a region without actually addressing these issues of the past. Yet at the same time, if you only regard them as being in the past, you're denying the opportunity to change the future as well. So I guess that's where we see both the legacies part of our volume and the prevention part of our volume as really intertwined, because dealing with these legacies is a crucial component of creating a different future.
Well, I think you've done a wonderful job in the book pointing that out and expanding our knowledge. And I just want to say a brief word of compliment to the publisher, who kept the price tolerable compared to many, many publishers who make it essentially only available to libraries. And it's wonderful that ordinary people can go out and buy those. I have to say, one of the results of my reading your volume is to make me recognize how little I actually knew about the region. So I'm going to give you a chance to enlighten me. Can you suggest, and our listeners, but mostly me, what one or two books would you suggest for people to read to start learning about this issue in East Asia, in Asia, aside from, of course, yours, which should be the first on the list?
Of course.
Deborah?
Look, I think Ben Kiernan's the Pol Pot regime is certainly an absolutely essential read. If readers are interested in learning about the genocide in Cambodia, and more broadly, Kiernan's genocide and resistance in Southeast Asia as well. And I think also one of the books that was just absolutely illuminating for me to read was Mao's Great Famine by Frank Dikeiter, which just gives an extraordinarily harrowing and detailed account of the Great Leap Forward in China. So there are a couple of suggestions from me about learning more about specific genocides. Annie, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, Ben Kiernan's been a real trailblazer in this area, I would say. I'd also add to that his 2008 book, which was Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur, I think is the title, in which he incorporates quite a few Asian case studies, including Japanese military expansion and China under Mao. And in terms of looking at, I guess because my main expertise is on the 1965 killings in Indonesia, I would recommend for that topic Robert Cribb's work. He did an edited volume about 20 years ago now called The Indonesian Killings. But there's a more recent volume too by Douglas Cameron and Catherine McGregor called The Contours of Mass Violence in Indonesia. And together those two volumes offer quite a broad study of these killings. Yeah, I think that's what I would recommend, yeah.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I just have one more question for each of you, and that's pretty simple. What are you working on now? And Annie, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Well, what I'm working on now grows out of my previous research, mainly on the 1965 massacres. I'm now broadening my analysis to incorporate cases of mass atrocities across the Indonesian archipelago between 1999, which is basically the period of authoritarian regime. And so I just got back last week from a research trip to Timor-Leste to collect information about the Indonesian occupation period, and later I'll be returning to Indonesia a few more times, doing a little bit of work in Aceh and perhaps later in West Papua. And mainly I'm focusing on forms of torture and ill treatment, so physical, mental and sexual forms of severe harm by particularly the Indonesian police and military against civilians. So that's pretty much taking up most of my time now.
And Deborah?
I'm actually looking at some cases of almost genocide at the moment. So what I'm looking at is cases in which there seemed to be a very high risk of genocide, but then genocide did not eventuate or did not eventuate at the time of crisis in question. And what I'm trying to tease out is the role of inhibitory factors in reducing the risk of genocide in high-risk nations. We know a lot about risk factors, about how risk of genocide develops over time, but we know much less about how that process is sometimes non-linear, how risk of genocide sometimes actually decreases, and how countries can display resilience in the face of risk of genocide. So at the moment I'm looking at 8 case studies where there seemed to be this very high risk of genocide, but it did not in fact occur, to try and identify some of the inhibitory or ameliorative factors which hopefully then can feed into the growing field of genocide prevention.
Well, this sounds like a wonderful project, and I hope that somewhere down the line after they come out that you all will be willing to come in the program again and chat with me about them. But for now, I want to say thank you so much. It was wonderful, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Deborah Meyerson and Annie Pullman, editors of the book Genocide and Mass Atrocities in Asia, Legacies and Prevention. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll interview John Roth and Peter Hayes about their contribution to the Oxford Handbook series, the Oxford Handbook of Holocaust Studies. Until then, I hope you have a great month.